Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Coffee Clutch. Today's show is Global Autism, Exploration of Autism Across Cultures with Kat Horton. Relate to Autism is the brainchild of Kat Horton, an autism practitioner who has worked with more than 800 children and families and is currently conducting doctoral studies at the University of Lancaster in the United Kingdom and Mark Tumanaska. Kat has been our guest previously to discuss this baby of hers, which is just fantastic, Relate to Autism. It's an incredible tool for parents with children on the spectrum, and it is here on our Blog Talk and Archive, and you can listen to it anytime. You can also find them at RelateToAutism.com. And she is back today to discuss a global outreach project that she's leading. The project, the World Autism Views Project, with Saturday being World Autism Awareness Day, we could not think of a single guest who could, you know, be more timely. And with so many questions still unanswered and so little scientific information translated from English into other languages, we're still in the dark about how many across the globe view autism. So the World Autism Views Project aims to give a voice to people everywhere so researchers can design appropriate programs for children. The survey is available in over 20 languages. It is going on now live, and the results will be available on May 1st on an interactive map, which you can find at Relate to Autism. Today's show will be hosted by Elise.
Hello.
Thrilled to have Elise joining us. Welcome, Elise and Kat. How are you?
We're good. Hi, Marianne.
Well, this is an incredible... Hi, Kat. This is an incredible undertaking, and I can't wait to hear all about it. We have the tweet chat open, so anybody can jump on our automated tweet chat, and they can use the hashtag TCK. And if you have any questions for Kat or Elise, you can give us a call at 646-595-2881.
Well, good morning, Kat. Thank you so much for joining us. This is a very interesting aspect of autism that nobody actually talks about, and that's culture. And how would you consider that culture creates an understanding or perception of autism?
Good morning, Elisa. It's great to be here again and to talk about this project. I'm really, really excited about this because, as you said, this is really an under-covered area of autism, and certainly in the research field there's very, very little that's been done looking at, well, what is the impact of culture on autism? And when we talk about culture, we're talking about, it's sort of an amorphous thing to begin with, but when we're thinking about culture, we're talking about people's shared values. You know, people from a particular culture will have shared values, things that are important to them, shared views and shared understandings of the world. And obviously, these differ greatly across the globe. And there has been almost no research that has looked at, well, how does that impact children with autism. There's been research that's looked at how does that impact parenting, but it's never really been applied to autism. So we're really excited to sort of start this process.
That's great. Now, just quickly about your survey. Last I heard you had the survey is up in 25 languages. Have you added some more languages to that, or...
Currently, it's available in 25. I think we have another 6 that we are processing that should be up either today or tomorrow. As we started to get this out there, people just started spontaneously sending us translations into their language as they wanted to bring this to their country. So we were really, really thrilled to see that happening. And it is available online, and it's an anonymous survey, so people can just go, and we want people just to be as honest as they can be and just answer all the different questions.
That's absolutely great. Now, let's talk about your work with parents and why you're basically doing this. You've worked internationally with a lot of parents, and you've seen the differences. Can you tell us about some of the groups that you've worked with and how you perceive that it changes from group to group?
Right. So this idea sort of came to me earlier this year. In January, I was out in the Middle East working with a group of families there. And as I sort of started to explore their country and their culture and understand, kind of what was the general understanding of autism, it really hit me how important this is. And how, you know, the general mission of Relate to Autism, which we started in 2009, is to bring, as Marianne was talking about, bring these online tools to people to make it really accessible for parents, so that parents everywhere can be empowered to do something and to help their child in some way. But when I went out to the Middle East, I realized that wasn't going to work. We couldn't just take what we do here in the West and just start applying it to other cultures, because they're coming from such a different place and have often a very different view of the world. They have a different view of family. They have a different view of parenting and what they want for their children.
Mm-hmm.
So being able to just take what works in the West and just apply it to another country doesn't necessarily make sense. And I realized that there was a lot more work that needed to be done before we could just sort of go in there and start using our Western-based techniques. So that's really where the idea came from. And then I realized that through going through that process, that one of the barriers in many parts of the world to people, parents even seeking help for their child, is the general cultural perception of autism.
Oh, really? So what would be the differences that you found? I mean, we still have issues with how people view autism here in the West. How? Mm-hmm. What kind of perceptions did you find in the Middle East?
Well, this is going to be interesting to look at. Is there a big difference across different cultures, or maybe it's just a difference in degree?
Okay.
And that's hopefully part of what we're going to find out through this survey. But certainly one of the things that I found where I was in the Middle East was that there's a perception of autism as a terrible thing, as something that's very negative and something that reflects badly on the family. There's a lot of sort of shame associated with having a child with autism or actually with any kind of special needs. To the degree that people... I've met some families who would not seek help in any way. They wouldn't take their child, even though there were some services locally, not very many, but there were services that they could take their child to. They wouldn't, because that would involve admitting that they had a child with special needs.
So that's
a huge barrier.
Yes. So do they then feel that this is somehow a punishment for something that they've done in a past life or a sin that they had or... something more, you know, to do with, punishing the parents, or is it about the children? I mean, how does that work in?
Yeah, I've come across all sorts of different beliefs, and you know, even if we just stay in the U.S.,
right.
There's a huge range of beliefs about autism, and everybody has their own opinion about what causes it and what's the best way to approach it, or even if you should do anything different, you should just let the child be as they are. You know, there's a huge range of beliefs because there's no expert consensus as of yet. We still don't have consensus on what is causing autism, what's the best way to approach it medically, if at all, what's the best way to educate children with autism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's so many different camps in the field that believe their way is the way, but there isn't yet a consensus. So obviously that leaves parents in a situation of having to make some kind of decision, and amongst all of these differing opinions, it's parents that are left there, you know, trying to make some kind of sense out of it.
Right. And that's very interesting, though, because we see, rises in autism cases here in the West, particularly in the United States. You see it in Western Europe. And as you go farther east, there seems to be less cases of autism. Do you think that that has more to do with they're not being reported, as opposed to what many are saying is a worldwide epidemic?
Well, right now we just don't have the data. So if you look at the actual peer-reviewed published epidemiological studies, which there are very few, and if you go to our website, to relatetoautism.com, and you click on the World Autism Views page and scroll down, we made an interactive map. It's like a little Google map where you can see all the different prevalence studies that have been done over the years, and there's one that shows you the timeline, how that's changed over time. But the most striking thing when you look at that map is that the big gray areas, which is most of the world, where there's just been no research, or certainly nothing that's been published in peer-reviewed international journals. You know, and as I talk with families or with organizations in most of Africa, India, they're just starting to do some prevalence work in India, but there's nothing yet published. In China,
right.
Like they don't know how many children are on the spectrum. And they're also, their diagnostic techniques are not the same as ours. They're not using the same tools. So we don't even know if the kids they're calling autistic would be diagnosed here as autistic, you know, so there's a whole, it's kind of a bit of a mess as far as us knowing.
So the testing that we consider, typical for children here in the United States, even if you have someplace in China or in the Middle East, they're not necessarily doing the same tests that we're doing.
No.
So how are they coming to a conclusion? So we have no idea how they're actually even coming to a conclusion that a child may be autistic?
Well, no. Often they'll be using the DSM-4 or the ICD, which is the International Classification of Diseases. So there's sort of international guidelines that have been out for years.
Mm-hmm.
But they're pretty vague compared to a lot of the standardized testing that's been developed and used in the U.S. So it's hard to know exactly how accurate, you know, in terms of a Western diagnosis, how accurate these diagnoses are. But the main issue is that the research has just not been done. The prevalence work has not been done. So, you know, everybody says it's a global issue, and I believe it is. You know, I've spoken to families all over the world who have a child that appears to have autism. But we do not have the statistics from outside of the Western world to be able to know. And that's kind of an essential piece for us to be able to say, well, is this really increasing globally? We don't know.
Right. Now, you talk about cross-cultural differences in parenting styles in dealing with the autism. Can you discuss that a little bit more with us? What you've experienced firsthand? How it may be handled in a different country?
Yeah, well, as I was saying, there's such a huge range of beliefs that people have, even in the West. But then as you start to go to other countries and talk to people about autism and their understanding of autism, I mean, I've heard all sorts of different beliefs. So you were talking earlier about the idea that autism is seen as a punishment.
Right.
And I've talked to people all over the world who believe that. I've talked to people in the West, mothers who believe that they have a child with autism because of something that they did wrong during their pregnancy. You know, I have a lot of mothers who feel guilty that maybe they ate the wrong thing or they took the wrong medication or something, that they feel somehow responsible for that.
Right, there's a lot of guilt involved. Believe me, there's a lot of guilt involved. You know, you just can't get away from that, trying to figure out what you did wrong. But I don't know if too many parents, you know, feel that it's sort of, in the West at least, I don't think we see it as like a punishment for past sins or, you know, we think that we messed up somewhere. There's no question whether it is you drank too much coffee or you got the wrong medications or something. But I think it's a different perspective than what you have in the East, where people actually think God is angry at them and this is how God has come and punished them.
Exactly. So it ends up with the same feeling as sort of guilt and shame. But, yeah, the Western perspective might be more one of, yes, is there something sort of biological that I did during pregnancy or pre-pregnancy? Whereas, yeah, certainly in the Middle East, I encountered people who did very much believe that this was a direct punishment from God for something maybe they or their family may have done. Then you go to India, a lot of people are Hindu, and they believe in reincarnation. And so I've heard people tell me that they believe this must be something that happened in a previous life, and this is the karma for that. This is the consequence of something that was done that they have no idea what it was. And so this is just the way it is. And these beliefs are important. Other ones that I've heard, actually, and I heard in the Middle East, were that autism is caused by evil spirits.
Right.
And I have heard, I have also heard people tell me that they believe that autism is a gift, and it's a gift from God, and that they are the chosen people to be able to deal with this child, and they feel very special for
right.
having this child.
I know. I've heard a lot of that in the United States from a lot of people that, excuse me, that they feel that their child's autism is actually some kind of gift that they were given.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think in many ways it's maybe a coping mechanism that we as parents have to try to come up with all these, and we base it upon our culture. What kind of coping mechanisms have you seen internationally that parents, besides this, I mean, what do they do? Do they have a lot of family support? You say that sometimes families are embarrassed, but do people rally around the families, or are the families sort of shunned because of this situation?
Right, yeah, and that very, very much depends on the general perception of disability. I would say autism, but a lot of people in many countries just aren't aware of what autism is, or they
right.
don't distinguish it from other kinds of disabilities. And so it very much depends, you know, so there's a lot of, certainly in the Middle East, I would say that there was, from what I saw, which is a very small piece of the Middle East, I have not traveled extensively throughout the region, but for what I saw, that exactly, parents were shunned or families were shunned, and they hid themselves, or they would literally hide their child because they didn't want people, you know, to know that their child was had special needs. And so that obviously has massive ramifications for the child. They're not getting the kind of interaction and stimulation that we believe could really help them to become more engaged and more social.
Right.
And then at the same time, parents, I mean, you know, even parents here who have children with autism often end up feeling very isolated. They can't find a babysitter. You know, it's hard for them to go out to regular places with their child. So you can imagine in a society where you feel like you just cannot literally take your child out of the house, that these parents end up feeling very, very isolated, even though they may be living in extended families. You know, there may be multiple generations and an extended family living in one building, but mothers particularly can end up feeling incredibly isolated because they're not really able to share their child with other people.
Right, and
then you
create another issue, and that is parental depression and how that affects everyone around them. And the child themselves. I mean, has anybody, talked or looked at that issue as well?
It's starting to happen, and you would think there would be more research on the effects of parental well-being on children and how their children develop.
Mm-hmm.
And there is some in the autism field. There was some interesting research, I think, done by a Dutch researcher, I can't remember, that looked at, they had two groups, and they did a basic sort of behavioral treat intervention program with these two different groups, and they measured the parent level of stress. And what they found across all of the families that they worked with was that the degree to which the behavioral intervention was effective, so how much the children learned basically and progressed over I can't remember if it was 3 or 6 months, but that was directly related to how stressed the parents were. So that when the parents were more stressed out, and they reported being more stressed, then the same behavioral intervention had less impact on their children. So that the effects of parent well-being are huge. They're really impacting how well their children are able to, you know, grow and process any kind of services they are getting.
Right. And the thing that I think that you may have found, or you mentioned in our discussion, too, is though in these societies where they have these, attitudes or I would in many ways say fear of disabilities, there's lack of services. Apart from the fact that people don't even want to necessarily take their children out there, there really is nothing for them. Is that true?
No. Yeah, absolutely. In many parts of the world, there's very little. So that even if, you know, parents did kind of get up the courage to say, you know, hey, I need help with my child, there's very few very few places for them to go to. And part of that, again, is a sort of wider perception that, you know, people don't want to take on a career working in special education because it's just not something that anyone really talks about. It's not considered
a good career?
It's just not. Yeah.
Really? I mean, it's okay to be a teacher, just not a special ed teacher?
Well, in the country that I was in January, there was no special ed teachers. It just doesn't exist as a concept.
Really?
So it wasn't. Yes, they have schools, and every single child in this country goes to school, and they have actually a really high literacy rate. But the concept of special education just doesn't exist. It's not something that, you know, as a student, you're going through college, you're learning to be a teacher. It's just not an option available to you. It's not something that's there.
It's Marion. I just had a question. Do the children with these disabilities go to school, or are they isolated and kept home and hidden?
Again, it varies. I mean, we're talking about huge, huge parts of the world, and there's variations across all these different countries. But where I was in the Middle East, that these children could not manage in the regular school, and there was no special ed teachers or no therapists there to help them. So there is one in this country, this entire country, there was one private autism center. And if you couldn't go there or you couldn't afford to go there, then, yes, the children were at home. They would stay at home. And not stay at home in the way that we might imagine, in that there's some kind of home program going on. They're just at home.
Right.
Well,
that in itself, you know, is just so incredibly sad. I mean, we have problems here in the United States, but the idea that there is no place for these children to go. But I have an interesting question, because your work that we're talking about revolves around the Middle East and with the culture of honor. Now, have you done any work with, like, the Japanese? Because they have also a very big culture of honor, but they have an understanding of autism, and they have, like, a special ed programs and stuff for these children. So I was just wondering if you've looked at how honor has a different approach in different cultures.
No, I haven't. That would be very interesting. No, we haven't got that far yet. At this point, certainly in the work in the Middle East, it's, you know, as you can understand from what I'm describing about the situation there,
right.
it's very much more basic than that. It's really just getting people to open up to the idea, that of what autism is, and that it's okay. You know, that it's okay for you to have a child who has these challenges.
Wow, that's just so overwhelming. To me, to even have to, like, think along those lines. When we talk about our, we have our Western educational approach to how we would even do this, or how we even deal with autism. And then you talk about the different cultures in the other parts of the world. What would you do different? I think that's very important. How would you approach it differently? Because I think in many respects here in the United States, we're kind of in your face. We, apart from the fact that we have laws that protect our children, and the more we have access to the internet and information, the more parents are learning how to really advocate for their children, this doesn't sound like being in your face would be, like, a good way to go in these other cultures. You know, it's like, you know, I'm here, you will take care of my child, you know, that kind of stuff. How would you even think that these people could go about? I mean, let's say that they get past the cultural issue of, you know, being of the shame or having, you know, bad thoughts about the fact that their child has a disability. How would you approach the situation since the societies are so different?
Yeah, well, that's exactly the question. I wish I had the answer at this point. That's what we're trying to figure out. So the wider piece of this project, the World Autism Views project, is step one of this. My ultimate aim is to be able to design parent support programs that will be appropriate for all these different countries? And that is exactly the question. What does a parent support program look like in the Gulf? What does it look like in India? What does it look like in Saudi? At this point, I have no idea what it's going to look like.
You know, that's interesting because I was under the impression that there was a huge autism center. I think it was is it in the UAE or Dubai?
Yeah, there is. There's a Dubai Autism Center, absolutely.
And how does that work? Because this is my own uneducated knowledge about this stuff. I mean, I would have assumed within that society there was more of a openness about autism because, I mean, that center exists.
Yes, in the UAE, absolutely, there is. And Qatar, places in the Gulf that are more wealthy, and there's a lot more of a Western influence there.
Uh-huh.
And yes, there is. There's a couple of big centers there that are doing very similar things that you would expect, in the States. So there's definitely, when we're talking about an entire region, if you're talking about the Middle East or even if you're talking about India or China, I mean, there's huge, huge places with millions and millions of people. And even within one culture, obviously, there's huge variations. And you can see that in the U.S. between what people believe and how open people are.
Oh, there's no disagreement here in the U.S. at all.
And we're all on the same page.
Yeah. That's just very interesting. And how are you actually approaching it? Let's talk about culture now in the United States, because as we talked about, Americans have different ideas and different ways of doing things. And we have, actually, I would even say the United States has a vast, difference in culture and how people approach that. I mean, what have you found here in the United States? I mean, apart from the fact that everybody always argues about everything here. I mean, how are parents approaching things here? And how is that affecting what happens?
Well, if we look on a sort of on a global scale, there are, as I said, there's not been any cross-cultural psychology research done in autism, but there has been a lot of cross-cultural studies in psychology in general, trying to look at can we classify different cultures and is there sort of underlying patterns or themes where we could lump a bunch of people together and say, okay, this is one culture and this is different from this culture.
Right.
So you were talking a little bit earlier about the Americans kind of being in your face. You described it, which was interesting.
Well, at least the Americans around here. I don't know. I'm in the Northeast, so we're sort of in your face about everything over here.
So, but one of the sort of major themes that has been explored a lot outside of autism is the idea that you can classify societies as either collectivist societies or individualistic societies.
Uh-huh.
So the U.S. is sort of the epitome of the individualistic society, where we here value very much, we value autonomy, we value our freedom, we value individualism, the idea that we are each an individual and we each have our own thoughts and we can each create our own way in the world as individuals. That's a very, very Western way of looking at the world.
Right.
The sort of the opposite of that, or the kind of the other end of the spectrum of this particular dichotomy is what are called collectivist societies, which are societies where what's much more important is group cohesion. And these are the places where you will find extended families that are very, very tightly knit together,
mm-hmm.
and that they think it as a group rather than thinking about, okay, what can I do and what is good for me as an individual? They'll think about the group as a whole. So if I'm making a decision, I've got to include I've got to think about everybody, the entire family or the entire group, however that's defined, I'm going to do something that's going to work for all of us. And that's a lot of emphasis on group harmony.
Right.
So if you're thinking in that way and if you're living in an extended family, you can imagine also there's an emphasis on maintaining harmony. They're less likely to go into to approach some kind of conflict, whereas in the West, the emphasis is much more on, well, this is my opinion and this is my truth, so I'm going to say it, versus in collectivist societies, it's much more about, okay, I'm not going to say it if it's going to create disharmony in the group.
Okay. you know, that's interesting because I think I'm approaching this from a very Western philosophy. Because I would think, you know, like if you have like this group think, okay, and you have one of the members of the family that needed something, I would think that the group would get together and would make sure that that happened. But it's a very, you know, because I could actually tell you right now, we live near relatives, my husband's relatives, and if anybody ever did anything to one of my children, my sister-in-law, she put the kibosh on all of them. You know, like she you don't mess with her nephews, you know. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's like sort of like family and group think. And I think, I think for many of us in the United States, we can't wrap our minds around the idea that group think doesn't include that.
Well,
you know what I'm saying?
Like going to
war sort of to get your child or the person with the disability what they need to have. Do you see what I'm saying? For many of us, our groupthink as our family is a cohesion. That's just part of it. It's not, it's like we march together kind of thing. So I think if you could try to explain that a little bit more, because I don't get it.
Right. Well, and it makes sense, and exactly that would be the logic that you would follow, right? If you were thinking about group cohesion, then everybody, you know, you'd be protecting everybody, and that's where it's come from. And, you know, sort of anciently, that's how societies have maintained themselves and survived. But if you also simultaneously have this belief that the child with the special needs is somehow a reflection of God's punishment on the family or is somehow dishonorable, then you're not going to stand up and fight for that. You want to hide that because you don't want other people to see that. It's a lot about sort of how other people perceive you, how other families perceive you.
I forgot about that part.
Thing.
Yeah. Right.
So there's all these conflicting beliefs, and that's why it's so kind of challenging to pull it all apart and understand, you know, what is the thinking behind this? And essentially that's what I'm trying to get to, that I know that in order for me to be able to provide support to families in these kinds of situations, I have to understand how they're thinking first. I can't just go in and say, okay, this is what you've got to do and this is what you should think. It's just not going to work. I have to understand what are they thinking, how do they put this all together in their minds, so that then I can begin to have that conversation with them. And that's what part of the World Autism Views Project is about, is giving people a voice so that we can hear from them and start to make sense of, okay, here's our perspective coming from the West about autism, and here's your perspective. How do we kind of meet in the middle and make some kind of collaboration here?
Right. Now, here's another question. Do they have a lot of outdated, I mean, apart from the idea of evil spirits or God's punishment, do they still hold to a lot of the outdated concepts of autism, such as like the refrigerator mother or that, you know, there's something that the mother's, you know, it's just generally the mother's fault?
Yeah, I've definitely heard different versions of that, yeah, and whether it's coming from sort of a psychoanalytic point of view, you know, it's sort of coming from a Freudian understanding of psychology, or it's just, you know, the mothers, I mean, in most societies, let's face it, it's the mothers who are looking after the children on a day-to-day basis, and so they are often held responsible for the child's behavior. So especially if you're in a society where conformity is very much valued, you know, which is pretty much the opposite to what we have here. You know, we want our kids to stand out, to be different, to be individuals, to think for themselves. You go to China and it's very different. People want their children to fit in and to conform and to be a part of society. And so if you have a child with autism who's not fitting in and not conforming and doesn't act like other kids, then often it's the mother that's blamed for that. And that's the same here. I hear that too also, that, you know, mothers are blamed for the way their children are behaving.
Right. You know, it's like the old idea, you need to punish them more. If you didn't if you spanked them, then they'd behave. It's just a apart from that, just like kills me, the idea that if you beat a child somehow that they'll behave better. But
yeah. I have a question, Kat. I was wondering, now, this project that you're doing, what types of questions are you asking, and what information are you hoping to get that will change the way that you prepare programs for children all over the world?
Well, at this point, this is, as I said, step one. There's absolutely more to be done. But at this stage, we're asking things. We have a bunch of different statements. The survey essentially is a bunch of different statements about autism. And then you can either kind of disagree to what, or agree or disagree to varying degrees each statement. So we're trying to sort of capture, and then we ask people to identify their country of origin, their ethnicity, and their religion. So we're trying to kind of figure out, is there a pattern here? Is there people from a certain country or people that identify themselves as a certain ethnicity or religion that are holding, you know, these different beliefs or not holding these beliefs? So things like autism is caused by evil spirits is one of the things on our survey. We've also got autism is caused by vaccinations, agree, disagree, to various different degrees. And so there's a sort of a whole list of these beliefs out there about autism, and it's not about are these right or wrong, true or false, it's just do I believe this or not? And so if we can start to understand kind of what is the basic view of what is the perception of people in these different countries, including the U.S., I'm fascinated to see if there's any sort of consensus here, then we can start to look at, okay, these are the, you know, if we come across a country that everybody believes that autism is caused by evil spirits, which I think is unlikely, but if we did, then we know that that's kind of where we have to start in our awareness campaign. There's no point us going in and talking, you know, from a Western perspective if that's the general underlying conception of autism.
Marianne, I have to tell you, I already took Kat's survey. And it's really very straightforward, and it doesn't take very long. So anyone who's listening, it's maybe 5-10 minutes of your time. And I think it asks some really interesting questions, issues that actually are an overview of the issues that are going on within the autism community that we talk about almost on a daily basis on our show. So, And, you know, I would really be interested to know, too, when it comes to the United States, where the differences are as well. Like we were talking about how the United States itself has so many different cultures. Mm-hmm. You know, whether a lot of how we view autism ourselves is from the culture of our parents and our grandparents, too. Like, is there a difference, and then is there a difference regionally? Have you found out anything about that, or you haven't had the chance yet? It's just all too new.
Yeah, no, I haven't had the chance yet. There has been some work done, especially out of California. They've got a lot of wonderful statistics and big databases in California about autism. And there has been some work published in the last few years looking at cultural differences within California and you're finding, I think they were looking more at service-seeking and finding that the Hispanic population were much less likely to seek services where their children were being diagnosed later.
Right.
Not because they were necessarily showing symptoms later, but just because it was taking them longer to get to someone who could diagnose them.
Well, isn't there anything that you may also, you know, culturally it could also be a problem for people that are in different cultures, you know, people that English is the second language that are in the United mm-hmm. States and vice versa for other countries, that if a child really isn't speaking or isn't speaking well, you know, that could easily be missed. But, you know, I actually can't wait to see the results of this because I'm curious to see how what we're going to be surprised with. About other cultures and other parts of the world and how they deal with it and maybe what, you know, the United States is going to learn from them.
Absolutely, yes. And also the degree to which, you know, globalization has happened. You know, lots of people have access to the Internet. Not necessarily, obviously, if they're not reading in English, then it's challenging to find information about autism. There's very little, certainly like in Arabic, there's very little autism information or any of the research that has been translated into Arabic. So But there is that. That's sort of the wild card is the internet, that people are, you know, out there reading and educating themselves, even though there's not necessarily services in their local city, they can still get on the internet. You know, I met one woman when I was in Oman who'd lived in Egypt most of her life, and she'd never been able to get any kind of therapy for her child. There is some available in Egypt, but it was so expensive, they just couldn't afford it. So she had gone on the internet, basically taught herself how to do ABA, and she had developed her own PEC system. She'd printed out all these cards and laminated them, and it was basically taught herself how to do this. And I watched her work with her son, and it was absolutely incredible, you know, that she was really making a big difference for this child. And it was, she learned it all off the internet. She hadn't attended a course. She barely could afford to buy books. She'd just been reading articles on the internet. So
I think that's why Relate to Autism is going to be so huge globally. You know, you were on before and you spoke about Relate to Autism, but, you know, at least you know more about the program than I do. I mean, how do you think this is going to affect children around the world?
Go on, Elise. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't realize you were addressing that to Elise, Marianne. But this is one of our goals, is to be able to reach people that don't have access to services. But obviously this project has to come first so we can really understand what is going to be applicable to them.
You know, but coming back to the whole idea of the internet as the savior, having raised children with autism pre-internet, there was nothing out there. And I can actually say that since the internet has become so big, whether it's Twitter or Facebook or it's just information that you can just access, and this is within, I think, maybe 5 or 6 years,
yeah.
Life has so profoundly changed for all of the parents globally when it comes to autism, because while Kat talks about the woman who had to teach herself who lived in Egypt, there are so many people here in the United States that can't afford the services because it's so expensive as well. And I think that Kat's entire program is going to be helpful here to the United States, to people here, as well as, you know, in part in the third world. I think that it's an amazing idea where you can self-teach and self-check and learn this concept of isolation. If we could push more and more of the technology, that it's going to be actually what I call the godsend to a parent of a disabled child.
Kat, can you tell us a little bit more about the Relate to Autism and how you got involved in this project and how the two of them will be tied together?
Well, Relate to Autism, we've been running since 2009, and as you said, we have these online tools for parents, which are really very much pitched for parents who are already involved, actively involved in some kind of treatment for their child, whether it be some kind of medical treatment, educational treatment, sensory treatment, whatever they're doing for their child. There's these tools online where they can collaborate with all the different people that are involved, keep everyone on the same page, and also track very specifically how their child is responding. And we have a wonderful tool that helps people kind of log each day what they're doing, and then it generates charts and graphs to show them, you know, over time what are the patterns. So they can get really specific about what's working and what's not working, because as we all know, every single child on the spectrum responds differently. And so for each parent, they have to kind of figure it out for themselves. And this is parents in the U.S. that obviously have access to more support than anybody does anywhere else on the planet. And still, it's very, very challenging to figure out what's going to work best for my child. So that was where Relate to Autism came from, was an attempt to help parents as they're kind of acting as general contractor for their child, and they're navigating between the speech therapist and the OT and the PT and the teacher and the doctor and trying to kind of keep it all together in some kind of cohesive way. But then the other piece of it, well, there's three pieces really, is that it's sort of empowering parents to manage their own programs. It's about enabling parents to connect with each other and connect with other parents who are doing similar things. And then also about, you know, giving parent access to information, because you said there is so much information out there that part of the challenge becomes then that it's overwhelming and you can't filter it and you can't kind of figure out what's so much of it is conflicting as well, that it's hard to figure out, you know, well, which piece do I actually follow? So that's another thing that we're going to be adding over the next few weeks, actually, as a large resource center within the website that gives parents access to all the relevant research publications, well-written articles, instructional videos, you know, all sorts of different resources from across the web that we have sort of filtered for them so that they don't have to do all of that researching, but it gives them kind of a place to start, and then they're categorized by different developmental areas. So those have always been the goals of Relate to Autism. And then we, knowing that we have this platform and it's online and that there is just every day there's millions of more people that are accessing the Internet, then that this is where we'd like to go with it, is to be able to make it accessible to people in other countries. But as I said, we need to understand more where they're coming from first before I know that what we're doing is going to be effective for them.
Right. Now, you talked, though, on the Relate to Autism, your grow through play system. So how would that work on a culture-by-culture basis? I mean, would you have to change that a lot?
I don't know.
That's
the question. That's exactly what I'm trying to figure out.
Coming back to the big issue, right.
I know. But this is actually forming the later part of my my PhD work that I'm still involved in, is this. So the intention is to design a culturally appropriate parent intervention, you know, an intervention program to be run by parents in a Middle Eastern country. And so, yeah, I don't think that I can take what is currently what we call the growth through play system, which are all these techniques that have been found to be effective in the West. I don't think we can just take that and just insert it into another country. I don't think it's going to work. We haven't tried it yet, but I think there's definitely some adaptations that need to be made. So, for instance, a lot of our techniques that we use in the West, and you know, the things that we do with children with autism as far as educational and sort of behavioral programs are really just sort of amplifications of parenting styles in general in the West.
Okay.
So if you look at a lot of the techniques that people are using here, whether it's coming from a behavioral background or it's a more developmental approach, a lot of these things are starting to use, you know, very similar techniques anyway. And certainly what we do here involves a lot of face-to-face work. It involves a lot of what we call object stimulation, so we're trying to encourage the child to share attention with you, with an adult, and with an object, and that sort of is called triadic joint attention. Can we pay attention to the object while still be engaged with each other? You know, and there's a lot of kind of focus on that and symbolic play, which again is playing with objects and using objects to represent different things. So a lot of what we're doing in the West is very much focus on those sorts of things, and shared affect, you know, sharing emotion, big facial expressions, a lot of exaggerated facial expressions to try and encourage that from the child. And these are sort of pretty much accepted and unquestioned at this point techniques that we use. But you go to, you know, so you mentioned Japan, Marianne, you go to Japan where expressing big exaggerated emotions is not part of the culture. Then trying to train parents to do that with their children is, I don't think, is going to be particularly effective. And is it going to be useful for the child in the long run anyway, if they're in a society that's very, very different from ours?
Now, Japan had a really interesting PSA. They had a video that was out. I think Rethinking Autism had promoted it. And it was just really stunning because it was this child, and he was obviously autistic, and he kept drawing the same with a crayon just, you know, over and over.
Oh, I remember that. That was
and,
a great PSA.
That's
yeah.
fabulous. It's fabulous. And he winds up that they have him put in, you know, a psychiatric hospital. And, you know, everybody's just looking at him, and then all of a sudden they realize that, you know, these papers that he's been drawing on are not just individual papers. When you put them all together, they made a huge whale. And it just really showed culturally in Japan how the view changed when they put that piece of the puzzle together. Actually, I'm going to send that to you because you would love it.
Yes, that sounds great. Yeah, so there's a lot. So this is exactly the question, Elise, is how do we take these techniques that have come from our Western ways of interacting with children, you know, which is coming from this idea that we're looking, our socialization goals, the things we want for our children are about independence, and are about autonomy and that child being able to kind of be their own person and think for themselves for all of our kids.
Right.
Which is different. It's not necessarily what parents in other cultures want for their children. So given that all of our techniques have grown from that kind of basic philosophy, what makes us think that they're going to be relevant to people in India or people in China or people with a
very
different...
That's very interesting. You never think about that. I mean, I guess that's my own, what do you call it, my own cultural bias, but I would never think that that would be an issue because here, like we said, it's all about being independent and individual, but in other cultures, it's basically you need to get the child to function so that they can be more homogeneous with the group, that he doesn't stick out, as a matter of fact.
Right, now, exactly.
Now that's interesting because also when you talk about the globalization then, how does, you know, in the internet and they can get information, but aren't cultures sort of just, would you say cultures are starting to mesh a little bit across the globe, though, in many ways? Do you think that that will affect how autism is then viewed in different parts of the world?
Yes, it has to. I don't know how rapidly that's going to happen, but definitely. And there's been some, again, as I said, there's been no cross-cultural research done with autism, really, but there's been a lot done on parenting styles.
Right.
You know, and just how parents interact with children in general. And there is some fascinating work coming from a group in Germany that have looked at, you know, very minute detail of video interactions, mothers and infants, usually. And they sort of started to be able to classify these interactions based on the wider cultural context. So they see in America, or they're doing with, you know, in suburban Germany, you know, which is similar. They're, you know, watching mothers and infants, and there's a lot of this face-to-face, exaggerated emotions, object stimulation, as I was talking about. And then they've been working with, sort of at the other extreme, a tribe in northern Cameroon that are very much a subsistence farmers. That they don't have TV, they don't have the internet, they don't, you know, they barely have electricity. They're subsistence farmers in rural Africa, and they're watching, you know, similar. They've gone and videoed mothers and infants, and they see a very, very different style of interaction. They don't see the face-to-face. They see body contact. They see mothers holding their infants close to them, but looking in the same direction. And, you know, they're talking about the things they're looking at, but they're looking in the same direction rather than looking face-to-face, which is just a very fundamental different view of the world.
Right. Wasn't there, a movie, I think, last year or the year before about the first year of life or the first couple of years of life for four children in different parts
babies.
Of the globe.
Was it called Babies?
Babies?
I didn't see it. Yeah.
I saw it, and it was absolutely fascinating because it's what you talk about. They had a couple in San Francisco. They had a couple Mongolian, you know, the Mongolian sheep herders. They had a family in Africa which has no electricity. And then there was a family in Japan. And how they all interacted. I mean, all the children ended up wonderful, happy, you know, delightful, delicious 2-year-olds or 3-year-olds. But it was just a very interesting perspective on how different parents parent around the globe. And it was from... And that's sort of what you were talking about now. It just, like, I just remember that movie. It was really fascinating. And I guess that comes back to how these families, you know, would have handled problems when faced with problems with their children as well. I mean, you know, they were very lucky within the movie. None of these children had any developmental or what they could tell by that time, learning disabilities or developmental issues. So it was just raising a neurotypical child, and it was absolutely fascinating. Exactly.
So there's these big differences in how we parent in general. So I have to understand more of that before I can say, well, okay, this is what you could do with your child with autism, because it's got to fit in with that general model. So I couldn't go to this tribe in northern Cameroon and start playing with objects and doing face-to-face and big exaggerated facial expressions is not going to work. They'd look at me like I was crazy. It doesn't fit in with the rest of their understanding, which is very much about body stimulation and contact and again, group cohesion and not not separating the child from the animal, not trying to create early autonomy. Whereas here, you know, we're expecting our one-year-olds to be autonomous little beings, whereas, you know, in different cultures, that's not expected to happen until much later, if ever, to the degree that we might.
Well, maybe you would want a one-year-old to be autonomous, but I'm not really happy with my 20-year-old being very autonomous. That depends, you know. I got this thing, you know. Much to the chagrin of my 20-year-old, I still want to hold on. Marianne, do we have anybody calling in for Kat? Marianne,
I guess. I'm sorry, I was on mute. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. we have only like about 2 minutes to go.
Yeah, we need to wrap it up. You know, this is just, it's such an incredible project that you're doing. Are you taking this on pretty much? Do you have people you're collaborating with, or is this strictly with Relate to Autism?
Well, the World Autism Views Project, obviously we have these collaborators around the world. If you go and look at the page, you'll see all their logos. We've got organizations from every continent that are helping us to distribute the survey and work with us on this. And then as far as the more detailed piece about designing an intervention program, there is a group in Oman that I'm working with, a parent support group actually, who have had to organize themselves and just get together because there is no sort of official services for them. So they have gotten together, and I'm going to be working with them and hopefully a group in India too to try and, you know, make something concrete that we can actually test and with various different groups of families and see how it works.
You know, and when I looked at the survey, I was actually a little surprised at the questions. And, you know, I think that when people look at it, you know, that once that you go through it, you realize how this is all going to take shape. And I think it really is just going to be incredible to really have a view of not only how parents view the children, but, you know, how we as you know, a world view these children. It's an incredible thing. I'm really proud to have you on.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, and we hope to be able, once we've got the results in, depending on what it kind of all looks like, we'd like to put it on a map so you see our prevalence map.
Mm-hmm.
So what we'd like to do is take some of these beliefs, we can't do it with all of them, and kind of just, you know, if there's obvious cultural or regional differences, we'd like to kind of display that on the map so we can really kind of all sort of step back and look at it and think, wow, you know, that's really different over there as to what they believe. Which I think is just good for everybody to see that, to know, as you were saying, Elise, it's easy when you're in one culture and you're surrounded by people that think the same thing as you, it's easy to just not question that anymore. Whereas when that's the wonderful thing about traveling to other places is that you're forced to recognize that is just one perception. The thing that you think is reality is just one perception. And that some people have a very, very different understanding. And to try and be constantly kind of toggling back and forth between those two, I think is just a good practice in general. So I'm excited to get these results in and put them up there for everyone to see.
I'm excited to see them.
Well, we'd love to have you come back on after you have all your data and discuss your findings. I just think it's so interesting.
Absolutely.
Good. Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Kat, for joining us. The website is relate2autism.com. I cannot stress enough. I think Elise and I are in complete agreement when we say that we think it is probably one of the best websites in the world.
Yes, no question.
Right now for autism, absolutely no question. And that's not just for saying in the United States. In the world, we think Relate to Autism is just incredible. So we cannot encourage you enough to go visit. Keep following us because we will be giving you an update on the findings of this survey. Kat, always a pleasure to have you. Elise, thank you for hosting.
Oh, you're welcome.
Tomorrow night, Daniel Pink, the author of Drive. If you need to be motivated, we're going to do it. You know, everything you thought about motivation, money, gold stars, rewards, think again. Daniel Pink is here tomorrow night, 9 o'clock, and we thank you for joining us. As we end every show, you are your child's best advocate. If not you, then who? Become an informed, educated parent. Thank you for joining us this morning on The Coffee Clutch.
Bye-bye.